KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to the first show of the summer quarter for Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today, for my inaugural guest for the summer, I'm excited to have on Professor Dave Opterbeck. Dave is a professor at Seton Hall Law, and I've known Dave. I met him at an IP conference several years ago, and I've monitored, which is a carefully chosen word, monitored his writings over the last several years. And I was excited a short while ago. He posted an email to a listserv of IP professors. This is about as geeky as it gets for IP law, where he shared very generously a data set that he had put together of the rulings and the outcomes of rulings involving the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, the FISA Court. And the FISA Court is going to be our focus today on Hearsay Culture. Now, if I had said FISA about a month ago on Hearsay Culture, I do think because of the listenership for Hearsay Culture, many listeners would have said, yeah, I know what that is. But post-Edward Snowden, post-PRISM, and this show is being recorded on July 2nd, where the last I checked, Snowden is still perhaps in a holding area in an airport in Moscow, a lot more people have heard FISA. So the timing of this interview actually couldn't be better, because I invited David on before all of the PRISM and national security surveillance issues came to light. But David was someone I wanted to have on the show because of this data set and because of his writing, to talk about FISA, talk about secrecy, and talk about how it operates. In the broad scope of the topics that we cover on Hearsay Culture, FISA kind of covers two areas of particular interest here, or maybe really three. The first is surveillance. The second is law, broadly construed. And the last is secrecy. Secrecy being a focus of mine and my own work, and the latter two being just broad areas of internet law and policy and technology that we've covered on Hearsay Culture really from the get-go. In fact, the first guest that I had on the show back in May 2006 was an online gambler, where we talked quite a bit about privacy issues there. Today, however, we're going to really drill down on FISA, the FISA Court in particular, what it is, how it operates. We're going to talk about David's work and David's data set and try to get our heads around what's going on right now from a scholar whose work has been published in a variety of areas, a variety of journals, including Georgetown's and Washington University, and like I said, whose work I've respected and gotten to know over the last several years. Rather than do a more extended introduction, I think given the fact that PRISM and FISA has been in the news today and has been in the news literally daily over the last month plus, and again, because the show has been recorded on July 2nd, so we have a timeliness because the show will air tomorrow, July 3rd, I am very pleased to introduce Professor David Opterbeck of Seton Hall, who is joining us via Skype from his office at Seton Hall in New Jersey. David, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks, David. Glad to be here.
Let's start off with a question I ask most of my guests. Tell us a little bit more about your background and why you started focusing on FISA.
Sure. So I've been an internet law person since really the internet has been available to us. There's an old New Jersey Law Journal article that identified me as the first lawyer in New Jersey to have an internet homepage. And that was a page I had coded in an old Unix account, and I got into quite a bit of trouble at my big law firm for being in that paper. So I've been doing all this stuff for a long time.
Congratulations. I'm going to interrupt you and say that's something that should absolutely be in your bio on Seton Hall's webpage.
You know, I had thought of putting it in my bio. The only problem is that I never managed to make any money off of that.
Fair enough.
Even during the internet bubble. So I don't know. Maybe it's good or maybe it's bad.
Okay.
So, I mean, I've been interested in this stuff for a long time. And about 3 years ago, three, 4 years ago, I was watching an episode of the show 24, which I used to enjoy, and on that particular episode, Jack Bauer saved the world from Chinese hackers who were trying to get into the U.S. power system. And I thought to myself, this is ridiculous. I mean, the show is ridiculous, but I love it, but this is just over the top. And as it turned out, the next week or two, the Wall Street Journal ran a number of articles, and it was sort of the first wave of publicity about the really serious problem of cybersecurity, and it got me really interested in that whole area. And coincidentally, at the same time, we had an opportunity to get some grant funding. We started up a cybersecurity law program here at the law school, which is part of the institute that I run. So I developed a class in cybersecurity. We developed a skills course. We did a big conference series, and we've done a number of, I've done some roundtables with government people and a number of other things. And it also led to me writing a couple of papers in this area of cybersecurity. And my first interest in it really is the question of internet governance and the freedom of the internet as it relates to national security law and the authority of the U.S. executive branch. If you remember, a couple of years ago, there was a lot of debate over a possible internet kill switch in one of the bills that was before before Congress. So all of that really got me to dive very deeply into these questions about what is happening now in terms of security and the internet. And one of the big things that really became prominent after 9/11 is some amendments to the FISA statute, the activity of the FISA court, and then some additional surveillance activity that was even outside of the FISA court.
Now, let's to contextualize this discussion, I guess I'll ask this first question. I said FISA, I even define the acronym, but I want to start with the basics. So literally, what is FISA?
FISA has a really interesting history. So it's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and it was actually signed into law by President Carter in 1978. And if you look into the reasons for it and the history of it, it really came out of the Watergate era and the Vietnam era. And, you know, at the time, if you kind of recall this history, it's a really fascinating history. There was a lot of covert activity going on. There were assassination attempts, surveillance, President Nixon authorizing surveillance, of course, a lot of things that mirror issues that we're worried about today. And one of the things that Congress did in the wake of all that was to pass this statute to actually try and constrain the ability of the executive branch to do surveillance. Of course, it's recognized that surveillance is necessary as a part of national security, that it can be a legitimate national security function. It's recognized that, you know, and this is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So the question here is activities that involve foreign nationals who may not be protected by all of the U.S. constitutional protections that apply to citizens with respect to things like surveillance and gathering information. And so how do you constrain those things if they're not necessarily constrained by the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment and the requirement of getting a warrant from a court? How do you constrain it? And the idea was that this statute would have certain standards that the executive branch would have to meet, that they would have to go to this special court that is set up under the statute and get an authorization to do the foreign surveillance that that they wanted to do. So that's really kind of the history of the act and the history of the court that was set up under the act. Now, it really functioned kind of in obscurity, I think, up until 9/11. And, you know, we can talk about my data a little bit later, but One of the things when you look at the data, there's really a very, very small number of requests that come through the FISA court to authorize various kinds of foreign surveillance before 9/11. After 9/11, one of the big problems that was identified in the 9/11 Commission report was the separation, and they used the term a wall of separation, between law enforcement and intelligence communities, really between the FBI and the CIA and the NSA. And, you know, there was some testimony before the 9/11 Commission that suggested that the FBI had certain information about Al-Qaeda and bin Laden, that had the security agencies had it, perhaps they could have done something to prevent the attacks. And so there was this big push to try and break down that wall, or at least make it easier for these different agencies to share information and to gather information. And part of that, that's all wrapped up in the Patriot Act. And part of what the Patriot Act did was amend FISA in a way that broadens some of the definitions in FISA and makes it actually quite a bit easier for the government to show that they need to obtain certain kinds of information. And that really broadened out the scope of what the government can do under FISA.
So we've got a law that's been around, ballparking 25 or so years, maybe now closer to 30, 35. And you mentioned 9/11, and these issues are now front and center. But before we get to PRISM, if you can go into a little more specifics, what changed after 9/11 vis-a-vis FISA before we even talk about the court itself?
Yeah, so really specifically, what changed were certain definitions in the statutes, in the FISA statute. So in the past, it had to be that the executive branch, the attorney general, going into the FISA court had to specific intelligence-related purpose to the surveillance. And it's sort of an analog to the warrant requirement under the Fourth Amendment. If the criminal FBI or the police is wanting to get private information on a citizen, absent a whole variety of exceptions that might apply, they need to go and get a warrant and show that there's probable cause that a crime has been committed or is imminently likely to be committed. So you have to make this kind of showing. And it was sort of similar to that. It wasn't quite probable cause, but it was showing that there was some specific intelligence-related need for that information. The shift in definitions on that front was really that the executive only had to go into, the attorney general only had to go in and show that a foreign citizen or an agent of a foreign power or a agent of a terror group was being targeted. So it really shifts from the substance of what's being done to simply the entity or person that is being looked at. And that really significantly broadens the standard and makes what really was a pretty easy order to obtain even much easier to obtain.
So, Dave, if we think about the court itself and structurally, what do we know about its makeup? Who are the judges? Where do they come from? How do they get on the court?
Yeah, so the judges, you can actually go on, there's a Wikipedia page for the court, and if you go on there, that's one source where you can see all of the judges. So we know who the judges are. They're all sitting federal judges who have ordinary assignments in district courts. It's not really entirely clear what the criteria are for their appointment. They're appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. One of the criteria in the statute is that they have to reside within a relatively close distance of the District of Columbia in case they're called to hear something on an emergent basis. They have a 7-year term. They can't be appointed to more than one term. But beyond that, we don't know a whole lot about what the criteria are for which particular judges get selected.
Are the judges, to be clear, or I'll ask, do they go through a nomination process?
I don't believe they do. They're appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a lot of information on who recommends to the Chief Justice, who should be appointed. I imagine that there's some kind of list, and I would imagine the executive branch has a hand in that, but I honestly don't know.
Okay, and just to be clear, they don't have the traditional, therefore, hearing that you'd have in the Senate when a district judge, for example, is appointed.
Right. I mean, well, they're already sitting district judges,
right.
So they've been appointed. If you look at the list, two of them are from the District of Columbia District, one's from the Eastern District of New York. So they've gone through the advice and consent process to get that position.
Right.
Like various other things that sitting judges do outside of their ordinary position, a district judge, for example, might sit by assignment on a circuit court for a short period of time if a court is shorthanded, things like that. I think it's structured to be viewed in that way. Mm-hmm. But it is a unique thing in that the particular qualifications in terms of national security issues isn't entirely clear beyond just being a federal judge.
So it's treated as an administrative move the same way that, as you just said, any other administrative move once you've gone through the advice and consent process would occur.
Yeah, and even a little bit less. It's not quite a move because they're still sitting in their original mm-hmm. capacity. It's just that they're also part of this court and therefore on call to hear applications when they arise.
Okay. We're talking with Professor Dave Opterbeck of Seton Hall Law on KZCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, Dave, you alluded to a little bit earlier, but again, particularly for those that are not lawyers or those who are not fully immersed in this issue right now, what kinds of cases would be brought into the FISA court and who would bring them?
Yeah, I mean, the FISA court doesn't even really hear cases per se. What it hears is applications from the executive branch, typically from someone in the U.S. Attorney's Office, for an order authorizing surveillance under the FISA statute. So all this court does is hear these requests for orders authorizing this surveillance.
So there's literally no litigation that goes in front of a FISA court.
Well, very rarely there is litigation, and I have to qualify saying very rarely, because part of the interesting issue and I think problem with the court is that it is a national security related court, so all of its proceedings are secret. You literally cannot get transcripts. You usually can't get the bodies of any of the orders that the court issues. You know, the one that Snowden leaked, obviously you can see kind of the results of leaking that kind of order. There are, I believe there are two or three reported opinions. But I should mention, by the way, there's the FISA court, and then there actually is an appellate body, the FISA Court of Appeal, which is structured similar to the FISA court with existing federal judges. So there is a level of appeal. And again, those opinions and proceedings are secret. So there's a couple of cases early on dealing with some of the procedures that the court uses. And so occasionally an entity that is subject to or potentially subject to an order of the court might object and might be able to make an appearance and have that objection heard. And in the very rare case, that might result in some kind of litigation. In an extremely rare case, it might result in a reported opinion, but even that opinion is going to be heavily redacted.
So when we're thinking about FISA, and I guess, you know, and we're getting into the weeds really of civil procedure here, so my apologies to listeners who are here to hear the more juicy, salacious stuff. But before we get to that, I'm thinking from what you're describing that the function of a FISA court is very similar to an administrative law judge, where they're handling a very narrow range of cases. Their opinions, I'm assuming, and I shouldn't make this assumption, but if there's a FISA Court of Appeals, presumably the next court to appeal to would be the Supreme Court, or is that the final court of the FISA appellate process, being the appellate court within the FISA statute?
I believe you could take an appeal from the FISC, from the FISA Court of Appeal to the Supreme
and,
Court.
And has that happened to your knowledge?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, so we're dealing with a court of limited jurisdiction, where you'd have specific issues arising under FISA that would go there. Let's talk about that secrecy in a little more detail, which is a nice segue into your data set. So I'm a U.S. citizen, and I want to attend a FISA court hearing. I'm assuming the answer is I'm not going.
Yeah, you can't. The hearings are closed. The proceedings are sealed. The results, the orders that are issued by the court are all sealed. They're all considered national security information and top secret.
Can I even find out that the court is sitting on a given day?
I don't believe you can.
Okay. So we're dealing with a level of secrecy, which is obviously, as you mentioned, national security type treatment. And again, I know I'm getting into the weeds of secrecy here, but I think this contextualizes how interesting your data set is. And I'll talk about how you got it. And I'm assuming I'm not going to hear a Snowden type story. But with regard, I'm assuming if we are, then hearsay culture is making more news than I planned today. But with regard to those last questions, if I want to, as a private citizen, do anything in front of a FISA court, do I have any options at all? In other words, let's say as a private citizen, and one that may not even be U.S. citizen, I realize that I've been subject to some kind of surveillance that falls under FISA. Do I have any standing or any way to appear in front of that court?
No, you really don't.
Okay.
Private citizen. So, like I said, on a few occasions, there have been entities who've received the order to give information, who've been able to appear, but I'm not aware of any private citizen ever being able to, and I don't think there's any procedure that would allow you to.
Okay. So with all of that jurisdictional background, let's talk a little bit about your data set. So, again, you circulated this data set very generously on the IP Profs listserv for, general academic use. Tell the listeners about the data set and how you got the data.
Right, sure. So, the U.S. Attorney's Office is required under the FISA statute to report to Congress once each year on the previous calendar year's activity in the FISA court. The only thing that they report is how many applications were filed, how many of those that were filed were granted, how many of those that were granted were modified, how many applications were withdrawn. So that's all the data they give. They don't give any substantive data. So there are a variety of places where every year's report from the Attorney General is available, and so I just obtained each of those letters for all of the years that they were available and collated the data from those letters.
And to bury the lead, what, broadly speaking, does the data set reveal?
Well, I mean, it's probably not – well, maybe it should be surprising, but it isn't that surprising that it's extremely rare, based on this data, for the FISA court to deny a request. And when I say extremely rare, I mean less than 1% rare. So almost every request that is submitted is granted. It's less rare, although still very, very rare, for the court to modify a request. And it's unclear from the data why a request might be modified. At least in one or two instances we're aware of, the statute itself requires that the request specify what the statute calls minimization procedures. So this is procedures by which the data will be sort of sifted and maybe scrubbed a little, and some effort made to not disclose personal information of people who, presumably aren't involved in any kind of problematic national security activity. So there are at least a few occasions we're aware of where the minimization procedures were modified in some way. Although even in those cases, we're not entirely sure how it was always modified.
So we don't really, with the limit, and to be clear, the data set that you have goes back, about 20 years or so?
Right.
And we're talking about hundreds of requests a year, and literally in most of the years there are zero denials, and then there's a couple in a few more recent years, but of course, as you mentioned, we don't know anything about those cases or why a particular request under FISA was denied.
That's right.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the data in more detail in a moment, because I want to just make sure that we have the context in place. So we're talking about FISA. We're talking about the FISA court. Now let's talk about what's happened over the last month. How does Edward Snowden and the documents that he revealed regarding this broad national security surveillance of electronic communications fit into the FISA Act and the FISA court?
Well, one of the documents that Snowden revealed was an actual order of the FISA court, and that's the now infamous Verizon order. And the scary and fascinating thing about that was the scope of the order. So whenever the administration or anybody sort of in the national security apparatus would ever make any kind of public comment about these kinds of surveillance programs, you know, they would suggest, well, listen, all of this is vetted by a court. It's scrubbed by a court. There are these very careful statutory procedures in place to make sure that we're not overstepping the bounds. You know, we don't care about your text or your email to your mother or your girlfriend. You know, what we care about is terrorism and Al-Qaeda and very specific things. And so, you know, that we want that to give us kind of a sense of, at least some sort of sense of comfort and assurance that, you know, this is really being going through proper legal channels and there maybe are reasons for secrecy. But when you get an order like the one that Snowden released, that doesn't seem to be the case at all. You know, the order basically requires Verizon to turn over everything. And it you know, gives the appearance that the federal government is sort of, you know, sticking a siphon into the pipe and just taking information out and then using or not using whatever sort of data scrubbing or screening procedures it might use on the back end. But it was kind of, I don't want to say surprising, but in its immediacy, kind of shocking or astonishing to see the scope of an actual order from this court. And it makes you wonder, out of the thousands of other orders that are issued, exactly what they say and what they authorize.
So let me ask what may appear to be an obvious question, but I think it's a bit more contextual. So, you know, you've said a few times, well, it's kind of not surprising that this is happening, and of course, at least from my perspective, the reason why it wouldn't be surprising is that we have a general view that, of course, this stuff is happening, and why should we expect this court that exists by virtue of the statute to do anything other than rubber stamp, and you didn't use that phrase, I'm going to use it, rubber stamp the request made by law enforcement in every instance. And I want to ask you, and we're going to take a break in a moment, but I kind of want to ask you this question from a theoretical perspective. As you think about why initially it wouldn't be surprising that this exists, where do you turn for your thoughts on that? Is it as simple as just general regulatory capture, that this is just another entity under control? Or in your view, is it more complex than that?
Well, in a way, it's more complex, but also more simple, and it's really a matter of history, of recent history, because shortly after, a couple of years after 9/11, it came to light that the Bush administration was authorizing warrantless wiretaps under another program, not through the FISA court, but under something called national security letters. So these were simply letters that the Attorney General's office would issue directly to, say, a service provider and say, you know, as a matter of national security and, you know, kind of based on some idea of the inherent authority of the executive in a time of war or a time of emergency, requiring certain information. And you know, that came to light a number of years ago, and eventually the Bush administration admitted and said, yeah, we were doing this, and we believe, you know, that under all these sort of theories that I just mentioned, that we're entitled to do it. So you kind of know that at least the Bush administration was doing even more than presumably they could do under the FISA court. So it's not necessarily that shocking, I would suppose, that the requests made to the FISA court were equally broad and sort of continue to be equally broad.
We're chatting with Professor Dave Opderbeck of Seton Hall Law on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it is on KZSU, which is a station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu or go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless of what you do, we hope that you continue to listen to the station and at least consider making a donation to the station. All right, Dave, let's get into more specifics here and kind of what this data tells us. The not surprising part is, you know, perhaps relatively clear with the context that you've offered now. But now let's get to the surprising part. I mean, with regard to the statute itself, I mean, presumably Congress and the president who signed it assumed that this court would be a check and balance against abuses of the FISA Act. And again, without clear data, or without any data really regarding these opinions beyond what's been leaked, and there's only a few of those, we don't really know what's happening. What can we say from the surprising aspect about this? I mean, to the extent that your data reveals anything, it's that at least superficially, the court's doing nothing more than checking to make sure everything's fine. And we could say, well, on one end, well, maybe that's because law enforcement is actually following the statute, or perhaps there's some other reasons. But can you postulate for me the theory or the concern from the not surprising, or from, excuse me, from the surprising standpoint, with regard to the data that you shared with the community?
Yeah, I mean, I guess two things. One is the volume of requests. Now, I mean, if you look at the data, you see, in a sense, not surprisingly, the volume go up significantly after 9/11. But in each year, there's, you know, close to 2,000, you know, 1,500 to 2,000 applications being made, and about the same number of orders being granted. And in raw numbers, maybe that doesn't sound like that many. I mean, if you compared it to the number of search warrants that an average, you know, state criminal court issues, I'm sure it's a minuscule comparison. But when you see an order like the Verizon order and how broad it is, and, you know, you realize there could be 1,700 to 2,000 of these orders coming out every year since 9/11, then you start to wonder, you know, what isn't being surveilled? You know, what is excluded? It's hard to imagine. Again, without knowing what all these are, maybe some of these are very narrow, but, you know, we have, I think, some fair reasons to think that they're relatively broad. So I think that's one sort of surprising thing. The other thing that did surprise me was the number modified, which, again, is really pretty small. You do see in some years, like 2003, there were about, well, there were 79 modified, you know, 2007, there were 86. And, you know, that sounds like a bigger number, but again, it's only 1 to 5% of these requests are modified at all. And since we don't have them, we don't know exactly what those modifications were. So when you put all that together, it really is difficult to see this court making any substantive changes to what the government is asking for. And I think you might expect, if the court is being very active with this sort of thing, or if the statute gives it leeway to be very active, you might at least expect to see more modifications to these orders, but we don't.
The data itself, which, by the way, I should mention, you are sharing via Creative Commons license, and which I will post to the Hearsay Culture website. And again, you know, thanks for being willing to do that. Also, would suggest something more broad, which is the nature of the oversight that exists more broadly in intelligence, which gets us really to this PRISM program and FISA's roles. And I want to get your opinion on that. So let's start off there. I mean, to the extent that we have any comparators, is this model, if you will, of checks and balances, a federal statute that exists to deal with surveillance issues or other issues that implicate privacy concerns or security concerns, and an administrative or judicial entity that's designed to be a check against it, a model that we see in other areas of law? Or is the FISA construct unique?
Well, I think we see the model in many other areas of law. I mean, I think, at least as a lawyer, you know, one of my fundamental instincts with this sort of thing is, especially where we're dealing with things that we think of as kind of basic liberty, interests and dealing with something where the executive has quite a lot of discretion is you want to see those checks. And often we do. And in the criminal law maybe is one good example, you know, very well established, going, again, all the way back to one of the basic reasons that the United States broke from Great Britain and we have a constitution with a Fourth Amendment is you don't want the executive, the police forces, and so on to sort of be able to arbitrarily break into people's private lives. You recognize, of course, that they need to break into people's private lives to keep order to a certain degree, but you want that to be governed by some sort of stable rule of law, and you want there eventually to be a judicial check on it, and that's what the search warrant is. And it's not all that hard. I have friends who are prosecutors, and it's not that hard to get a search warrant, but it is a meaningful check that requires them to put together some evidence and go to a judge, and sometimes they do get denied. So you do see that in other areas. Historically, you didn't see it in foreign affairs and surveillance, and there's a long history. A project I'm working on this summer falls out of all this but relates to the use of drones for targeted killings, and there's been a lot of debate recently about whether there should be a court to review some of those decisions. And the truth is, historically, that hasn't been much of a judicial function. It's been here and there on issues of habeas corpus and people held as prisoners and things like that, that we've expected judicial review, but we've given the executive and the military and the intelligence agencies pretty broad leash to in foreign affairs to do what they need to do, you know, subject generally to international law. So in a sense, the FISA statute and the FISA court was a bit of an innovation after Watergate in Vietnam. And, you know, one of the historically interesting and, again, kind of disturbing things is the way that this mechanism that was set up to provide this check now, you know, seems to have been subverted to help facilitate a broader scope of surveillance. It almost seems like it's kind of turned its original genesis around a little bit.
So, and again, we're chatting with Dave Opterbeck of Seton Hall Law on KCCFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, Dave, I think, you know, as we pivot here a little bit and talk about Snowden and what we've learned regarding surveillance, I'll ask you to characterize it. Obviously, it's been heavily in the news, and so many listeners, I'm sure a good majority of listeners are familiar with it. But given your expertise in FISA and in cybersecurity issues, how would you describe the information that Snowden revealed? What did he, putting aside all the hyperbole, what did he tell us, or what did his documents indicate to us that we didn't know before?
I think the key point is what we didn't, is the word no. I think that, again, it's not surprising that there's a program that the NSA runs that has, you know, again, if you look at the slides that that were released, you know, all these neat looking data flow charts and so on, it isn't really all that surprising that they're doing this kind of thing. But this sort of information really just tangibly and you know, a bit in your face kind of confirms, yeah, they really are doing this, and it really is extensive. So I think it's more of a visceral sort of shock that, you know, you kind of joke about it, you kind of think they might be doing this sort of thing. There are TV shows like 24 where, you know, you see things like this, and you sort of know in the back of your mind that things like this must be going on. But to get this put out and to see it in kind of graphic form like this really brings it home that, in fact, yeah, this is really happening.
But if it's merely confirming what we already knew, is there any reason why people should be all that concerned about it? In other words, to be clear and to push back a little bit, right? If we take what the White House has said to us seriously, and if we believe it, this this act and this process, which has led to, as your data points out, virtually no actions from this FISA court to change anything that law enforcement has done, has prevented terrorist attacks, has kept the country safe. And if we all kind of knew that this was happening anyway, and we're just confirming it, is everything that Snowden has told us with regard to PRISM, this acronym for the program, much ado about nothing?
I wouldn't say it's much ado about nothing. I was at a conference a couple of weeks ago for a wireless communications industry conference, and I gave a little talk on this stuff. And somebody in the audience, who actually was a lawyer, had a question at the end similar to the one you're raising now, and he said, look, I woke up the next morning, I read about all this, if they want to read my email to my grandmother, they can, and, I didn't wake up in the gulag. And I jokingly said, well, you haven't woken up in the gulag yet. And that got a nice little laugh from the audience. And I don't mean to be too dramatic about that, but I think the problem is, it's the old frog in the kettle problem. You just sort of tolerate more and more incursions, and you don't even realize the extent to which you're tolerating things. And I think perhaps kind of the cultural moment of the disclosure of this information by Snowden was for people to sort of realize, wait a minute, how did I get in this kettle of boiling water? And is there a way for me to get out of this kettle of boiling water? So I think it's more kind of a slap in the face, a wake-up call to say, at some point, you have to sort of stop this slide and go back to some first principles and realize that some lines really do have to be drawn or redrawn.
So let's talk about those first principles, and I, of course, I'm going to do that in the last 10 minutes of the show, which is what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I'm now going to ask you these questions. You don't have time to answer them. But to me, and this is something, and our work, at least tangentially, is related, because I often think about, and I have written about, issues involving transparency and public input and when the public should have information. And that's something I'm working on this summer. And to me, this statute falls in a long line of statutes that go well beyond any of these issues and to the law itself, where the focus ultimately and the reliance is on discretion. So in other words, we assume that the people who are going to be charged with actually implementing the policies that are set forth in a statute will exercise professional discretion, and so therefore there won't be abuses. And if there are, theoretically, right, the FISA court is designed to deal with them. Isn't that effectively what this individual lawyer who challenged you was saying? And if in fact it's the case that, as far as we know, and that's obviously a loaded term, but as far as we know, FISA has worked pretty well, shouldn't we be willing as a society to accept these changes?
Well, okay, so first I would have to challenge whether it's worked pretty well.
Okay.
Given the fact that it doesn't appear very many orders have been modified, given the scope of that Verizon order, I wonder. But as to the broader point, I mean, as Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify, right? Mm-hmm. Yes, we do have to vest a lot of trust and authority in the executive over the conduct of foreign affairs and war. And yes, I work with people in government, and I completely understand and agree that the threats are real. I mean, the threat of terrorism is real. We saw it again at the Boston Marathon. The threat of massive cyber attacks are real. And the need for surveillance, for secrecy in some of these things is real. So there are operational issues, but that if we're going to be true to our principles, I think we have to do that in a way that doesn't at the same time compromise liberty. There was a really interesting line in there's a case called U.S. v. Hamdi, which is a really significant case in the Supreme Court that dealt with the detention of terror suspects in Guantanamo. and whether they could be detained without having an opportunity to go to court at all. And there were a number of opinions in that case, and Justice Breyer wrote an opinion, and he said something like, there's always a tension between liberty and security. And that's sort of interesting, and in a real sense, that's kind of true. There is always a tension, but in the ideal sense, I think we want to say that there's not a tension. Ideally, our ideal is to say that we have security and we have liberty, and security is part of what facilitates liberty, and liberty is part of what facilitates security. So I think what we want to shoot for is not holding those two things against each other, but holding those things together. And my feeling, at least, again, just based on the information I've been able to see, is that this has slid. To the side of tolerating impinging some important parts of our liberty simply by invoking the name of security.
And so let's, you know, again, unfair questions, Dave. Let's talk about that liberty interest. I mean, you know, getting back to what this individual said to you, what liberty interest is being impinged in his case, or what? And I want to be clear: what might be impinged, because we don't know, and maybe that's the key point. But putting that aside, let's assume that there are risks here. What liberty interest is being impinged under FISA for this individual? Where you've got, and it's not just the executive, right? You've got administrative people, right? Human beings at Snowden's level and below, right? Who are actually implementing FISA. What liberty interest is being implicated by those individuals' actions if they are exercising reasonable discretion?
Well, one of the problems is if we use a term like reasonable discretion, we don't really know whether the discretion that's being exercised is reasonable. And, you know, one of the purposes of having some kind of judicial review is approval and review is to have a neutral forum in which you can assess that, right? So, you know, even setting that, that kind of concern aside, I think one of the other really fascinating and difficult dynamics of this issue today is the fact of the internet. The internet makes this kind of communication in some way different from the kinds of communication that people have been able to engage in, you know, in the relatively recent past. And further, it's different because most of what we're doing on the internet at various points is under the control of private intermediaries. So the big backbone providers like Verizon, the big data search companies like Google, and we have certain expectations with respect to our dealings with each other and our dealings through these entities. And we may not actually understand, probably most of us don't really understand legally how those expectations are governed in terms of service and what they say and don't say and so on. But we have some kind of expectation that we're dealing in a private sphere, and not really in a completely public sphere, or at least a partially private sphere, at least with some of our activities, some of our communications over this medium. And it's really just a unique moment in history when you've got these, we'll call them information infrastructure entities, that are private entities that are mediating all of this communication of ours and are almost in themselves a kind of governmental, quasi-legal type establishment, and then they are interfacing with our government. And how do you mediate those relationships? I think, you know, that's just a really fascinating, difficult question, but it raises, at least for me, issues about what I expect and what I think I should reasonably be able to expect when I'm using this medium that's really just become the spinal cord of our lives today.
So, you know, in a sense, the law is ossified, right, in a given time and space. And so, you know, theoretically, when the FISA Act, which is now antiquated at this point, based upon the date that you indicated, was written, privacy and security expectations might have been different. I'll ask you one of those magical questions, and again, unfair, because you have about 3 minutes to answer it. But if there were any amendments that you would make to FISA to address the concerns that you've raised, which are serious concerns, what would they be? Are there any changes you'd make within FISA itself, as opposed to more broadly, that might address the concerns that you have?
Yeah, I mean, two off the top of my head that I think of is I think that definition of when surveillance is authorized needs to be tightened up again. I think it ought not to simply relate to the party being targeted. It's way too broad. There ought to be a requirement of some kind of more specific showing of what sort of surveillance is being done and why. And I think that would, if it's being enforced, that would probably ratchet down things like this really broad Verizon order that we see. That's one thing. The other thing is I really think the FISA court needs to change in some way. And I'm not exactly sure how you accommodate the really important national security concerns, but it just can't be a completely secret court. There needs to be some mechanism. The whole purpose of, I think, of judicial review is that there's an independent body that provides some accountability, that provides some kind of reportage to the public. And I don't know exactly how that would work in a national security context, but I think some efforts need to be made to make that happen.
So, Dave, I don't ask crystal ball questions, so I'm merely going to ask this. I mean, as far as what you can tell regarding the star of the hour, Edward Snowden, again, this show is being recorded on July 2nd, and for all we know, by the time it airs tomorrow, things will have changed. But you want to give me a sense of your sense of, what's going to happen to Snowden, but what the impact of his activities will be, not only on FISA, but more broadly on the national security apparatus that exists, and I'll ask you to do that in your remaining 90 seconds.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there's going to be all that much impact at all. It's really fascinating. It was fascinating this morning to hear that various countries to which Snowden apparently wanted to go are refusing him entry, which makes pretty obvious that the U.S. Has put pressure on those countries not to take him in, and are cooperating with the U.S. in that. I think they're going to probably succeed in containing the damage from this, and you're going to see in the next year or two some comprehensive cybersecurity legislation that's going to even broaden some of these information sharing capacities that the government now has.
So in other words, now that we're on notice that this is happening, the government can take advantage of it and more broadly do the surveillance that the government claims is necessary to maintain our security.
Yeah, and I mean, and as long as people keep shrugging their shoulders and saying, you know, I'm not in the gulag yet, very little probably will ever change.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that leads to the last and loaded question. What would you advise a concerned member of the public to do at this point, if anything, to address the issues that are revealed both with your data set and in your scholarship and the work that you're doing?
Right. I mean, I think the most important, first of all, there's not much you can do to actually secure your information from the government, unless you just want to stop using the internet. But as a practical matter, I mean, educate yourself, understand how these statutes work, realize that there isn't, for the past few years, there's been a very active debate in Congress over comprehensive cybersecurity legislation. That debate is still going on. So kind of learn about what those bills say, and then hopefully you can make, you know, do the best you can to make your voice heard to your representatives and try and get some safeguards put in place for this sort of activity.
Professor Dave Opdorbeck of Seton Hall Law, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture to discuss this data set that you put together, and which I will post on Hearsay Culture once the show posts as a podcast in the next week or so. But thank you for joining us on the show. Obviously, this issue is not only not going away, but it's becoming more pronounced. I invite you back on the show, particularly with your work on drones, which is an area that we're going to spend more time talking about in Hearsay Culture in the coming months and years, I suspect. But thank you for for joining us today. I think it's been a good conversation, and I look forward to following your work and continuing the discussion.
Thank you, David.
I'm happy to mention the several guests that are coming up on Hearsay Culture. As it stands now, I am still finalizing the schedule. The summer quarter on KZSU's calendar is a little bit of a tricky one for me because I do try to take some vacation, so I record a few shows in advance. But among the guests coming up will be Professor Devin Desai of Thomas Jefferson Law on 3D printing, and a few others that at this point I'm going to say I will reserve for next week. I intend to post the schedule by the end of the week, and at that point I'll be able to lock it down more specifically. As always, you have a couple of ways to listen to the show. You can listen live on KZSU. This quarter for the summer will be Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Pacific time, or you can listen to the show via podcast, either by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to the iTunes page for CIS, or by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 180 plus previous shows, as well as by the end of the week, the upcoming schedule. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, at feedback@dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more great programming, and have a great day.